Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it truly possible for the world to stop relying so heavily on the finite supply of fossil fuel energy? And if so, what combination of clean and renewable power sources might be required to achieve that transition? For all their political and environmental consequences, coal and oil in particular have made us accustomed to the advantages of dense and portable energy at a relatively low cost. And as my guest today demonstrates in his new documentary, keeping up with modern energy demands while easing off on traditional fuel sources will require a wide-ranging and creative approach. Director Harry Lynch is in town for a screening this evening of his film Switch at the Landmark Magnolia Theater in Dallas at 7:30. He's with us now to talk about it. Harry, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me again.
So this film is unusual in the sense that projects like this that we've talked about even on the show typically take a position, the way things should go. And you wanted to simply understand the way they are likely to go.
That's right. Most energy films tend to be an advocacy piece or an attack on one particular energy or another, a shockumentary. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted to look at our energy transition, but mostly do that in a way that tried to be nonpartisan, that was as objective as possible, that was scientifically based, to try to figure out what that transition really will look like. And not what it should like, not say what it should look like.
And because this is an issue of global importance, you literally went all over the world. How important did you discover that, say, regional geology was in the alternatives and options that are available to different parts of the world?
Well, you know, all energy is regional. I mean, it's something that we don't really think about anymore because we've turned oil into a global commodity. Mm-hmm. Coal is largely domestic in many different countries, but still countries like China are importing huge amounts of coal from Australia. So all energy is regional, even solar. We tend to think that solar is everywhere, but, the farther you go in the northern and southern latitudes, you know, there's not so much of it. So all energy is regional, all of it is.
I was astonished to learn that Norway gets like 99% of its electricity from hydroelectric. Talk a little bit about what it took for them to build up that industry.
Yeah, you know, Norway is an astonishing country. We just talked about regionality of energy. At the time that Norway was building its energy system, oil wasn't a global commodity, and they didn't know that they were sitting on a huge amount of it in the North Sea, and they had no coal. But they did have huge amounts of water. It's very rainy, and they have mountains there. So, you know, they had waterfalls everywhere. And someone had the brilliant idea around 1890 that they could start generating electricity that way. So they had a brief experimentation with some coal plants, but eventually they built an entire electricity system on hydro, like we've done it in this country largely on fossil fuels. And so 99% of their electricity today comes from hydro, and the rest of it comes from wind. So,
which puts them in a great position, because if they choose then to export, I mean, obviously they need some petroleum for their automobiles, but if they choose to export energy, they've got a huge source of wealth there.
Well, yeah. I mean, Norway is one of the reasons that Norway is the wealthiest per capita country, large country in the world, is because they sit on a huge amount of fossil fuel reserves. I mean, they basically discovered oil and gas in the North Sea, I think in the 70s there. They export all of their natural gas, all of it. They're the largest exporter, or the second largest exporter of natural gas to Europe. And they are the fifth largest exporter of oil in the world.
We
don't think of Norway in that capacity. No, we don't. So they are energy independent in a way that basically no other country can be. So good for them.
Tell us about the way, for the purposes of this project, that you calculated the amount of energy that every person needs in a given year.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. We were trying to figure out a way to make energy relevant to the average person. Usually it's talked about in scientific terms, British thermal units, megawatt hours, et cetera, that don't really mean anything to most people. Sometimes you will hear it in kind of house equivalent, like, this power plant could power 3 million homes. But even that is not really accurate because we use energy in so many ways besides our homes. Our homes only use about 10% of the total energy that we use. So we decided to factor in everything that uses energy in our lives. That means all our food, all our clothes, the buildings that we live in and work in, the buildings that we just share a portion of, like government buildings or airports, and factor in all that energy and make kind of an energy footprint. So we came up with what is the equivalent of 20 million watt hours per year. That's what it takes to power a global person. That's a global average. And then we divided every single energy resource that we visit by that one person per year, you know, unit. So we look at basically every energy source by how many people it would power per year, and that makes it very simple. It's a very simple way to look at an offshore oil plant or a wind turbine or whatever. All of them are factored in that same way.
And no matter what, it appears that global demand for energy, particularly as the developing world continues to develop, is on the rise.
It certainly looks that way. I mean, most people think that global energy demand will increase by 50% in the next 20 years. I hope I have that number wrong, but I probably don't. Because, you know, basically you see China and India in particular developing. And now, you know, they have every right to develop. They have 1.3 billion people in those two countries that don't have access to electricity. Which is an astonishing figure. I mean, that's four times the United States that doesn't have access to electricity. And so they're trying to power those people to lift them out of poverty. They certainly have the right to do that, but that means a huge amount of energy consumption. Largely, that's going to be coal power, and so that means a lot of carbon emissions. So that's a big challenge, something we're going to have to figure out what to do about.
Do I have this number right? Was it 600 million people in India today have yet to get electricity to their homes?
That's right. 600 million people in India have no electricity.
And so clearly India's plan would be in the next couple of decades to ameliorate that.
That's right. They want to power those people basically to United States, and they want to do it in 20 years. It took us 100, so they want to do it in 20 years. And how they're going to do that is that's something that we should all be thinking about. India has said they're going to do it with nuclear plants, but not nuclear plants like we know here, thorium-based nuclear plants. Now, they have had more success testing thorium plants than we did. We tried that in the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I don't think we tried it in the right way. They're trying it in a different way and they're having more success. But they're talking about enormous aggressive growth in thorium nuclear there. I don't think they'll be able to sustain it, actually. So probably natural gas and coal are what are going to do that.
So coal is a huge resource in this country. It gives us half our electricity right now.
You know, that's one of the numbers in the film that has changed. Largely, energy changes happen really slowly. So that's good for a documentary filmmaker because you can be sure your facts will stay accurate for a few years. But that one has changed really, really dramatically. When we did that interview with the Undersecretary of Energy, he was quoting 2008 numbers, and it was half. Now it's down to 35%, and that's a stunning drop. And the reason it has dropped is largely because natural gas has become cheaper than coal. So, and we had a huge built-up inventory of natural gas power plants that were basically used as peaking power. They were used when the air conditioning loads were the highest in the middle of summer because they were more expensive to run because natural gas was more expensive. Well, now that natural gas is cheaper, we're running those more often and we're running less coal. So for the first time in U.S. history, coal and natural gas will produce the same amount of electricity. That's a stunning development. What that means for carbon emissions is that the U.S. has reduced its carbon emissions by 10% over those same 4 years, which is, at least from power generation, which is an amazing drop. It's more than any other developed country, it's something that's amazing. Now, all of that cheap gas has come at the expense of fracking, which is something that a lot of people are not very enthusiastic about. So, but, you know, that's one of every energy source is a mixture of costs and benefits. There's always a trade-off involved. And so what we have to ask ourselves is, you know, what are we going to prioritize there?
So in terms of CO2 emissions, some people think of gas as being sort of emission-free, and that's not the case.
No, that's not the case. Natural gas is about half the CO2 of coal, mm-hmm. and about a third less than oil. So, but it still produces CO2 for sure. It also natural gas is methane, CH4, and that is a powerful greenhouse gas in itself, 20 times more potent than CO2. More shorter-lived, but more potent. So producing a lot of gas and having a lot of it leak into the atmosphere, if we were to do that, and some people say that a lot of it is, has challenges of its own. Most of those studies have been refuted by other people who say that largely natural gas production is cleaner than that. But again, it's another thing to be looking at.
Did you find as you went from one industry to the next, from one operation to the next, that you got a lot of really different figures from people who seemed to you to be honest and trustworthy?
You know what's really interesting is, I mean, we tried to talk to the best in the fields. So we talked to, you know, the Undersecretary of Energy, the former Undersecretary of Energy, the directors of the Stanford University Energy Environment Programs, all kind of the best of the best across the U.S., across the world. And those people operate with a certain level of knowledge. It was amazing how consistent all their figures and all their findings were. Once you get to that level of people who are really informed, it was amazing, no matter what their industry, how consistent they were. And, you know, one of the things we try to do it in the film is try to bring the audience to that level, to try to build a baseline understanding, a practical understanding of energy, so people can look at it from that perspective. Energy right now is highly polarized. It's political. Information out there is oftentimes not very impartial. So what we try to do in the film is raise that level of understanding so everybody can get to that place.
Let's talk about that most highly polarizing phrase, clean coal. What you were told is that coal isn't clean right now. It could be, but it is exceptionally expensive to do it.
Yeah, well, it depends on how you define clean.
Mm-hmm.
If you define clean in carbon emissions, then there is no clean coal. There's not a single coal plant in the world that captures its carbon emissions. There are some that are in testing phase right now, but they're testing at very small scale. So they might be trying to capture 2% or 1% of the carbon out of that plant. If you define clean coal as in other kinds of emissions like SOx and NOx and mercury, we have some in this country. They're doing a pretty good job of capturing some, but not necessarily all of those things. So it depends on how you define clean coal. Now, if you want to make a coal plant truly clean and you're defining it in carbon emissions, then that means capturing all the carbon, or at least at the very least half of the carbon, so that it's the same as a natural gas-fired plant. And to do that is extraordinarily expensive. I mean, it's billions of dollars per coal plant. And so what that means is that a coal plant is suddenly no longer cheap, and that's really the benefit of coal. You know, I like to say that there's absolutely nothing good with coal electricity except for that it can lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So, you know, it has vast environmental challenges, but the reason that all countries develop and have historically developed with coal is because it's really cheap and it's domestic and it's easy to use. You know, you dig it out of the ground, you pile it in a heap next to the power plant, it demands absolutely no storage, and then you shovel it in and burn it. It's really, really easy. It's 17th century technology. And so that's what countries always use first. But in order to make it a carbon-free or a lower carbon resource would be so expensive, not the piping around of the CO2. We do that today. We actually pipe around huge volumes of CO2, and generally we pipe it out of one dome where it's gotten out of the earth, and we inject it elsewhere where it usually is used for enhanced oil recovery because it liberates oil in old fields. So piping it around is not the problem. Sequestering it, sticking it underground is not really the problem. Scott Tinker, who is the guide, the on-screen guide in the films of the director of the Bureau of Economic Geology, they're probably the world's kind of most advanced non-industrial carbon sequestration authority, and they say that's possible. But the actual cost of capturing it at the power plant is so expensive that we don't think it's likely to happen.
Filmmaker Harry Lynch is here. His new documentary, Switch, will screen this evening at the Landmark Magnolia Theater in Dallas, followed by a Q&A session. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Harry Lynch. His documentary Switch screens this evening at 7:30 at the Landmark Magnolia Theater in Dallas, followed by a Q&A session. He's also got a website that you can access at switchenergyproject.com. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, the email address is think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Just for a minute on the issue of coal and making it cleaner or sequestering more CO2, I just wanted to go back to you. You said it's essentially billions of dollars per coal plant to get to where you can do some of these things. Is it like a one-time capital cost, or is that annual maintenance and investment in regular kind of upkeep?
Yeah, well, first of all, we're not really sure what that would cost because nobody's done it yet.
Uh-huh. So that's an estimate.
So what we did was we went to go visit the kind of the leading carbon capture project in the United States, but really the leading one in the world, and looked at what they're doing, what it's costing, et cetera. So that's kind of where we and then looked at some other stuff, but that's where we got our numbers. It's about a $3 trillion project to install the capture technology. And that's assuming that the cost comes significantly down to install the technology across the world's fleet of coal plants. So $3 trillion, it's an awful lot of money. Now, what people don't often appreciate is it's a parasitic load on the coal plant. So it demands about 30% of the energy the coal plant produces to capture that carbon. So that means you have to burn 25% more coal.
Boy, that gets to be a vicious cycle, doesn't it?
Yeah, so you actually end up, you know, emitting more.
Mm-hmm. So we all know by this point in our history the problems that exist with fossil fuel. There are questions over the supply and who controls it. There's the cost. There is the emissions and pollution. Talk about what makes it so awesome, petroleum that is, for the things we've used it for the past century or so.
Yeah. Well, you know, we largely take all energy for granted, but we especially take, fossil fuels for granted. We've had them for such a long time, and we kind of always imagine that they'll be there. Gasoline goes up, you know, a quarter in price, and people start screaming as if, you know, they've got a right to cheap gasoline. But, you know, really, it's a commodity like anything else. But, you know, so oil in particular is readily storable. We can turn it into a global commodity fairly easily because you can stick it in a tanker at room temperature and at atmospheric pressure and ship it all around the world. You can stick it in a tank in Oklahoma and you can leave it there for 60 years if you want to, and you can pump it out and refine it and use it. So, you know, it's a very stable commodity. It's also extremely energy dense. Gasoline is 5 times the energy density of liquid hydrogen. So, you know, that's the reason that you can stick it in your gas tank and then you can drive for 350 miles on a gas tank that's the size of a picnic basket, and then just refill it in a few minutes and do it all again. And so it's that energy density. So portability, stability, energy density, and cost. I mean, it's still remarkably cheap for the utility that it provides us. So all those things make it very difficult to replace it. I mean, in a sense, cheap oil and cheap coal, cheap fossil fuels have built the economies of the developed world. They're what we developed on. And so now as we try to replace them, move on to something else, you know, we're going to have to try to compete with those things in utility and price and transportability and all those other things. And it's very, very difficult.
So we know that biofuels are ultimately able to be regenerated. Theoretically, we could have an unlimited supply. But there are some concerns, not least of which is their overall efficiency. It still takes a lot of work to create a gallon of biofuel.
That's right. You know, using the way that we make biofuels today, it's pretty much net energy neutral. So we're not really getting much energy out. We're using a lot of oil to plant those crops and then harvest and process those crops. And then we're turning that into another liquid fuel. So in order to make biofuels really a viable option, we need to move to second-generation biofuels, which are cellulosic. So instead of using just the tiny corn kernel, using the entire plant. And as soon as you can use cellulose, you know, the woody structure of any plant, the wood on this desk right here, you can turn basically any plant or any waste that has cellulose in it, into a biofuel. So, you know, at the moment, biofuels, cellulosic biofuels are 3 to 6 times as expensive as gasoline. So that makes them maybe not so practical right now. But some people believe, and some people who are, you know, up on this stuff, believe that it will one day be the cheapest form of liquid fuel. And so if that happens, you know, then they're really going to be something to be reckoned with. Now, at that time, you know, we use so much liquid fuel. We use so much energy that in order to meet a significant portion of that, we're going to have to use an awful lot of land or waste product or something to make that biofuel. The scale challenge really, you know, comes, we really start to feel that at that time.
And you want to ensure, I suppose, I mean, the land can't be avoided. You want to not have to irrigate a whole bunch because we're already really worried about water supplies, right? Are there certain crops used for biofuels that can be grown sort of without much care?
Well, that's what you want. You know, you want crops that need very little water, or ideally no additional, you know, water, and very little fertilizer, and very little energy used to harvest them. You know, there's not a lot of crops that meet that.
There's a bunch of junk growing in my backyard, but
I don't
know if
that
qualifies.
What you're looking for. You know, really, you're looking for weeds. Mm-hmm. You know, so perennial grasses where you plant them once, they establish a 25-year type root system, and then they grow, and you mow them once a year. You create hay, essentially bales, giant bales of hay, and then you need biorefineries, is what they call them, in the countryside. So, you know, there are 1.8 million acres, for example, in New York. The state of New York that are dairy land that has gone out of commission, essentially. So it's not good enough land for crops. It's marginal land. You could grow that kind of stuff there. You could mow it once a year, but then you need to put those biorefineries out in the countryside to turn that stuff into cellulosic biofuel. It's certainly possible, and I hope that it does happen. One of the best things we could do in the transportation sector is diversify. You want to be diversified in every other economic, portfolio. At the moment, we have exactly one transportation fuel, and that's oil. It powers 98% of global transportation in some form. And so it would be really great if we could diversify into biofuels and electricity and natural gas and, you know, anything else, because you want to be diversified.
What about the potential for CNG, compressed natural gas, for vehicles? We know it works well. You don't have to modify the experience of driving a particular vehicle. But in the film, it appears that this really is only practical at this point for fleet vehicles.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's a couple things that make it challenging. One is that you have to have compressors. The compressors are expensive. And the other thing is that you have to do the conversion of your vehicle. There's only one natural gas vehicle sold in the United States today. It's a Honda Civic, and it costs about $5,000 more than your regular Honda Civic, and then you need to buy a compressor for your garage, which costs about $4,000. So you got to spend $9,000 more to have that vehicle. Now, if you drive a whole lot and you believe that you're going to save $9,000 in fuel costs over time, then that makes sense. Or, you know, or if you're doing it for other reasons, you could certainly be doing it for a number of other reasons. But at the moment, you know, that high capital cost of getting into it means that it's probably going to be for fleet vehicles. And the reason that, you know, just in case somebody doesn't know, the reason it works for fleet vehicles is that they keep coming back to the same central place to refuel. Mm-hmm. So you pipe in a lot of gas, you build these expensive compressors, and then you bring your fleet vehicles back, like a UPS fleet could do it, a FedEx fleet, a garbage truck fleet, a mail truck fleet, any kind of big, heavy fleet could do this. And you're starting to see that. You know, Fort Worth, their entire bus system, the Dallas bus system, they just bought, I think, 200 or 400 CNG buses. Most airports now have CNG buses. So you're starting to see that. I think that's what's going to need to happen first. And then as people begin to see more and more of these things, as consumers get comfortable with that, then I think you might begin to see it penetrate into the consumer vehicle market. But I think that's probably something that's 10 to 20 years off.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Tim in Aledo. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. I've worked in the petroleum business for like 30 years and helped develop technology in horizontal drilling myself, so I like fossil fuels. But I'm also a scientist, and I think I understand something about the climate change challenge and climate science. And I saw your movie at the AAPG meeting in, I think, June with Scott Tinker. And I guess, you know, one of the problems I had in his talk, he discussed the continuing expansion of the use of fossil fuels because of the huge amount of momentum that we have in our infrastructure, and I think he may be right about that, but he got through the entire talk without really discussing the climate implications of those. And so I asked him a question about that, and what he said was that his scenario that he presented there would lead to something like a 6 to 8 degree centigrade increase in temperature. And that happens to be about 10 times what we've seen so far. So, you know, it's a big, big problem.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't come up. The 6 to 8 degree increase in temperature doesn't come up in the film, I don't recall. But maybe you can speak in a general sense to the comments by Scott Tinker, who's the host of the film.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that Tim brought that up because that's a very interesting point. You know, we try to look at, like I said at the beginning, what that energy transition really is going to look like, not what it should look like, not what giant policy changes or a vast, you know, complete overhaul of the energy system, which is highly unlikely, might cause, but what the transition really will look like. That forecast is about a 650 ppm world, which is hot.
Parts per million of carbon.
Of carbon in the atmosphere, yeah. So that's a lot. That's a lot more than a lot of people think that it ought to get to. I personally would love to see us try to reduce that. You know, but again, the film wasn't about, you know, making an advocacy statement. It was about trying to determine what that really looks like. I personally think that efficiency is the way to a much greater focus on efficiency is a way to get there faster. I think natural gas is a way to get there faster because it's abundant and cheap. And because it's abundant and cheap means people are more likely to use it. So, you know, I think we've had some very hot years here in this country recently, and Texas is in a drought. And if we have another 5 years of heat and more years of drought, I think you'll begin to see people's minds change on the importance of this. At the moment, it's not very important. And then as we talked about earlier, we have these giant countries, these giant developing countries of China and India and many others, who are going to be using a lot of fossil fuels to power themselves. I think we need to, a wise response would be trying to figure out a way to allow them to do that, to develop, to help them develop, but to do it in a much more energy efficient way than we did it, and in a less carbon intensive way than we did it. So, you know, he brings up very good points. We don't deal with carbon very much in the film, largely because we wanted this film to be, as I said, kind of what we think will happen. But we also wanted it to be nonpartisan. And carbon is a very partisan issue. And so, you know, making any kind of prescription based on what we think, you know, should happen in the world of carbon meant that we would alienate some viewers, meant that we would make this a film that only half the people would watch. So while you'll hear lots of talk about carbon in the film, mostly from our interviewees. We don't make it. And, you know, we talk about coal only in terms of carbon. So, you know, it's definitely there. It's just not the focus of the film.
You went out to the Perdido well, which is a couple hours south of Galveston in the Gulf of Mexico. Is that right?
That's right. We went to we wanted to go to the best energy facilities for their type in the world. And so Perdido is the deepest water platform in the world. It's kind of, you know, it's on the absolute cutting edge of oil production. And so we went out there. It took 5 times to try to get out there because it is 2 hours flight into the Gulf of Mexico by helicopter. And it's, you know, it's a remote and dangerous environment. And so either a storm would turn us back or there would be some medical issue of, you know, somebody had a appendix rupture and had to be flown in. So they got our helicopter. So it took us a long time to actually get out there and visit that place. You know, throughout the film, you know, there are so many of them, I think, that people don't often realize it, but you basically get to go to the best resources for their type across the country. So you get to go into nuclear power plants when they're operational. You get to go into a nuclear recycling plant in France. You get to go to Perdido. You get to go into coal mines, into coal plants, places that many of these things have never been filmed before. And certainly, I don't think there are a lot of people who have seen them. So one of the things that almost all audiences have really enjoyed is the chance to get in there and actually see these places, actually see what it takes to power the world. I mean, I think it's incredibly fascinating.
It is interesting. It's so easy not to pay attention. You plug something into the wall and it turns on, and you don't have to think about it unless you choose to.
That's right. I mean, people generally don't think about it. You know, I mean, we've done a really good job with kind of isolating ourselves from the kind of the dirtiness of energy. I mean, think about, you know, London and not that we were around, but London in the 1800s, you know, covered in a cloud of coal smoke and dust. You know, largely we have taken the dirty part of energy out of our daily view. You know, I filled up my car driving here today. And literally a minute after you've done that, you're driving around and you totally forgot that you just filled your tank with oil that was, you know, produced somewhere because we take energy for granted.
With more sites like Perdido coming online, and the film makes the point that it took like 14 years to build the platform and get it operational, so these things don't happen overnight. But in these isolated locations, are they more vulnerable to accidents, to problems like we saw with Deepwater Horizon?
You know, the more dangerous and remote your locations become, the more susceptible you are to having some kind of accident. So they try to plan for that. I mean, obviously they know that. That's a multi-billion-dollar platform. They don't want to lose it. So they've tried to, you know, it can withstand 50-foot seas or 100-foot seas. I forget what they told. I mean, you know, they try very hard to make it withstand all those kind of things if they're going to put it out there. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, it would be very hard to fix something if it broke it in 8,000 feet of water.
Do the workers like stay there for weeks at a time and sort of have beds?
They're on 2, 3, and 4 week shifts. And you know, the Coast Guard has a man limit on there, a person limit, 172 people, and it stays at 172 people. You know, all the time. That's absolutely full. It's you know, again, it's so expensive to put out there that you want it full, operational. You want it, you want it producing as much as possible.
Filmmaker Harry Lynch is with us. His documentary Switch screens this evening at 7:30 at the Landmark Magnolia Theater in Dallas. You can learn more about it at switchenergyproject.com. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, our email address is think@kera.org. Phone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Harry Lynch. He's in town for a screening of his documentary Switch this evening at 7:30 at the Landmark Magnolia Theater in Dallas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Okay, so how big can the wind industry get, and how much of our power conceivably could we in very windy Texas get from this renewable resource?
I would say 20 to 30%
of the total electricity consumption.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that would be a lot. Mm-hmm. We can do that because we have other conventional generation that we can use to back it up. And, you know, I hate to come back to natural gas again, but largely in Texas, we have 65% of our power comes from natural gas. It's been going down a little bit because of wind. Wind is growing incredibly quickly in Texas. Texas, many people don't know, is the United States' largest wind state by a factor of three. If Texas were a country, it would be the fifth or sixth largest wind producer in the world. So Texas is a huge leader in wind. Now, the thing about wind is that it's intermittent and its production is variable. It tends to produce a lot at night. In the wintertime, it tends to produce not very much, say, in the doldrums of August, which is when we use the most electricity because we're running our air conditionings. And so that intermittent and kind of erratic production of electricity has to be balanced with something else. And in Texas, we can use natural gas. Natural gas has the benefit of being fast starting. So we can start up a natural gas plant in 1 to 10 minutes. So if we know the wind is dying, we can ramp that up. The ideal backup for wind is actually hydro, because hydro can start instantly. You have all this potential energy and, you know, held up behind your dam or held up, you know, in your water resource, and you literally can turn hydro on instantly, in an energy sense, instantly. But so, you know, if you go beyond 20 to 30%, I mean, no one's really done that yet, so we don't know. But if you talk to the people who regulate energy in the state, who know, I mean, every day they regulate the flow of energy across the state, trying to meet our demands. They say 20 to 30%. Then the grid begins to become unstable.
What about technologies like geothermal? Are there really limited areas where this is practical?
Yeah, you know, any time that you have really high temperature near the surface, then geothermal is a fantastic resource. And you know, we should be – in most developed countries, we've taken advantage of that. There are some areas in Indonesia, for example, and other developing countries where they can and they are, and they should take advantage of that. You know, I mean, energy in the form of heat sitting, you know, a kilometer below the surface. I mean, why not try to tap that? Sometimes even closer than that. And when you do, you know, you have that phenomenal heat. You can use it to do a number of things. You can make electricity. You can heat homes. You know, Iceland gets about more than half of its energy from geothermal. Pretty much every home in Reykjavik is heated from steam that comes out of the ground and is pumped into their radiators. It's really an amazing system.
So, Harry, I'm 42, and I think since I was about 6, we've been talking about how solar is just about to sort of be a break-even technology, and we're still not quite there yet?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, the best thing that's happened to solar in a while is cheap Chinese solar panels. Mm-hmm. And normally that's – I'm not a fan of that exactly.
Phrases that start with cheap Chinese.
That's right, exactly. But that has really changed the solar industry. I mean, it's been bad for some American solar companies. It's been hard for them to compete with that. But if we want more solar, what we really need to do is bring down its cost. I mean, that's the Achilles heel of solar. It's just too expensive. You know, it's an intermittent resource. I mean, it doesn't work at night, of course, and it doesn't work when it's cloudy. But if you're using it as a supplement, and which is really what it should be used as, and when you're using it to chop the top off that demand curve, you know, we use very little energy or very little electricity at 3 o'clock in the morning, and then we more than double that at 3 in the afternoon as we bring on all of our industrial facilities and people are using all their, you know, consumer devices and their air conditioning. So that's when electricity is most expensive, that peak period. And that's also when solar is producing the most electricity. So if we can chop the top off that demand curve with supplemental solar, that's a good thing to be doing. But even when electricity is most expensive, solar is still more expensive than that. So the best thing we can do in solar is try to bring that cost down.
What are the impediments to creating some kind of fuel storage technology, a giant battery somewhere that could make it possible for us to take this energy that is surplus at the time it's being produced and hang on to it for when we need it?
Well, I mean, that would change the world. I mean, if you would like to be the world's first trillionaire, all you have to do is invent that energy storage system, because it doesn't exist. Because what we like about electricity is that it's not storable. I mean, you know, it's frenetic. It has to move. And so we pipe it down wires and we make it move things. We've been trying to store electricity efficiently and affordably for 170 years, you know, and we've been working on that for a very long time. So if and when we can perfect that system, it will change the world. That demand curve that I just mentioned to you will disappear. We will no longer have to dispatch energy, electricity right when we need it, which is what we have to do now. Essentially, our power plants sit dormant in the night. Coal plants and nuclear plants run. Every other power plant sits dormant in the middle of the night. And we ramp those up and turn them on and switch energy, electricity all across the country, you know, as we need it. And it's phenomenally, you know, inefficient and difficult and challenging and all those kind of things. And if we could store energy, all that would disappear. We make it whenever we've got an excess, and then it simply goes onto the lines when we need it. You could power, you know, Iceland, for example, could use all of its geothermal resources, power big batteries and float them on barges wherever we needed electricity. You know, if we could store electricity like we store, say, a pile of coal or store a tank full of gasoline, the world would change.
Do scientists think it's impossible?
You know, I mean, there's a lot of people working on that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the physics well enough. I particularly think it, I don't know. I'm not going to comment on that. But I know that there's some very smart people who have been working on it for decades trying to make that a reality. And let's hope that in our lifetimes it comes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Ron in Cedar Hill. Hello, Ron.
Hello. Mr. Lynch, plastic is ubiquitous, and it comes from fossil fuels. Do you have any idea of what percentage of our oil consumption goes into plastics, and can biomass technologies make plastics?
I think we use about 80% of the oil that we import, or 80% of the oil that we import or produce for transportation. So that means that 20% goes into other products. I'm not 100% sure on those stats, but I believe that's true. So plastics would probably be, a third of that. Most plastics not made in the United States anymore. Most plastics made in China and India and elsewhere. We can make it out of corn. We can make it out of some other things. I think that's a lot. If you talk to a lot of people in the Middle East, they say that, it's really too bad that we're using oil in our combustion engines, because wouldn't it be so much more valuable to use as a chemical feedstock? And certainly, if we used a lot less of it and we diversified transportation into other things, then we could use oil for our chemical feedstock. I think that still is a very valuable role for it. So will we see more corn type plastics and other products? I think we will. And other kinds of complex carbohydrates going in to create plastics, I think we will. But hopefully as we diversify our transportation system, we'll have more space for chemical feedstocks, or still remain space for chemical feedstocks coming from oil.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Derek is on the line now in Fort Worth. Hi, Derek.
Hello. Hello. I want to respectfully disagree with your guest.
All right.
Tell you what, I drive one of the Civic natural gas cars.
Mm-hmm.
I did not have to purchase a compressor for my house. I travel the Metroplex a great deal, and I don't have any problem finding stations at which to fill up. My average cost is between $1.89 and $2.09 a gallon.
Well, maybe more people will be in Derek's position in the near future, and we'll have more CNG vehicles in use by private individuals.
Yeah, I mean, he touches on a very valid, he touches on the issue, and that's fueling stations for people to be comfortable with it. It's like for electric vehicles, you're starting to see charging stations in some places. Now, the reality is you can't charge up. Let's say you're parked at the grocery store for 30 or 45 minutes. You really can't charge your car very much on one of those stations in that time. It takes longer than that. But the fueling station there is there to make you comfortable, to make you think, oh, my gosh, if I was running out of electricity, can I find any place? Oh, yes, I know there's one at the library, and I know there's one at the grocery. It's the same for natural gas fueling stations. As soon as there are more fueling stations, people will begin to feel more comfortable buying those kind of cars and using them. Now, good for him. I mean, I'm glad that he's got one and is able to find them. But, if he decided to go to Wichita, Kansas, can he take that car and comfortably feel like he's going to be able to gas it up? That's a different question.
It's a tough chicken and egg problem, because who wants to invest in the infrastructure before there is a significant market for it? And who wants to be part of that market before there is a reliable infrastructure?
Yeah, it's absolutely a chicken and egg question. That's why I believe that we need to get very comfortable with the idea from seeing all these fleets powered that way. And, the more fleets you see powered that way, the more of those fueling stations will continue to grow. And they've been also talking about different organizations trying to put them along major, say, highways. I-35 might eventually have natural gas fueling stations all the way up it. And if it did, certainly then you'd see people who live along it, you'd see them start to buy natural gas vehicles. I think it's going to come. It's just like most things in energy, it's going to take a long time. Cars last 20 years. Now, the car you have, you may not drive your car for 20 years, but somebody's going to drive it for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to transition out of that old car fleet into the new car fleet, and whether that's natural gas or electric or hydrogen fuel cell, whatever it's going to be, it's going to take time to transition into that new fleet.
And the end of your film is actually, again, about transitions. Really, the entire film is about it, but about the transition to more energy-efficient materials and technologies and things like that, which, again, even if today we have every brilliant technology we need to switch to, it's sort of a staggered process, right, by which people replace the things they had before with devices and systems that are more efficient.
Yeah, you know, I've said it before, but energy transitions take time. You know, imagine you've built a power plant. It's going to last for 40 years. So do you decommission that power plant prematurely when you have billions of dollars invested in it? Or do you wait till it lives its normal life and then replace it with something else? You know, when we looked at different countries like Denmark, Norway, Iceland, France, I mean, really any country that's made an energy transition, you're talking 25, 30, 35 years at a minimum. And that's usually to make a partial transition. Then the same thing goes for your car fleet. The same thing goes for your water heater or your air conditioning. You're not going to replace your air conditioning if you bought it 5 years ago, but you might replace it if it's starting to, you know, malfunction and you bought it 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there's always that time to replace things. But, the, you know, the good news is things get more efficient. I mean, the refrigerators today are three times more efficient than they were 30 years ago. The same, not exactly three times, but the same thing is for air conditioning. Those are more efficient. So we're getting about 1% more efficient in our technology per year without any kind of policy, without any kind of anyone driving it. And now if we can do 1%, you know, just kind of organically, couldn't we do 2 or 3 or 4% if people made an effort? And really, efficiency is where the opportunity lies. You know, efficiency is, I mean, it saves money. It doesn't cost money. It's applicable right now, you know, today. It not only saves money, but it also increases the security of supply. It increases the length of supply. I mean, there's absolutely nothing bad about efficiency, and except for if you are the one selling energy. If you're selling energy, you don't want people to conserve energy because then they're going to buy less of your product. So one of the challenges in efficiency is trying to get the people who sell energy, trying to incentivize them to find a way to be okay with selling less. And then there's the cost of the technology for the consumers and for the, you know, new power plants, et cetera. And then there's a cultural change. You know, we need to, just like we did with recycling, we need to begin to think that conservation and efficiency is important. We need to think about, you know, there are too many lights on in this room. You know, we need to think about that all the time. And the minute we start to think about electricity and energy as just one of those things we're always cognizant of, then 15 to 20% efficiency is easy. They've done a bunch of studies about smart meters that have, you know, basically having your electric meter sitting on your kitchen counter so that you're always aware of how much electricity you're using. And how much would you think people reduce their energy use just by being able to look at it?
30%.
Yeah, it's about 20%. Mm-hmm. 20%. And in study after study, 20% just by being aware. So all we have to do is become aware, and then efficiency becomes easy. And that, you know, that's a phenomenal difference. Imagine that we needed to burn, you know, 20% less coal, for instance. Nope, there's the music.
There's the music. Harry Lynch's new film is called Documentary. He's in town for a screening tonight at 7:30 at the Landmark Magnolia Theater in Dallas. That starts at 7:30, and then after the film, there will be a Q&A session. Harry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. SwitchEnergyProject.com. I should say the name of the website again.
Today's show was engineered by Eric Bright. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.